Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to the Off the Air Radio Show, brought to you live every Friday night on the Vibe Radio Network from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. From the Gun Room in Speedway, Indiana, I am your host, Aldo Gonzalez, moderator of the modicum, interviewer of the intelligent, and guiler of my guests. This is the place where I talk about anything and everything that interests me and where my guests are mighty, brave, and full of all sorts of useful information that will not make any of us rich, but only provide some entertainment for your Friday nights. No story is off limits. No guest is too big or too small. We may use profanity, so if certain words offend you, here is my apology for that now. You will always attempt to be professional. But in the end, we just want to have fun, laugh, and enjoy each other's strange and curious stories. That being said, make sure you've already gone to the bathroom, that you've got your cup of coffee or cup of tea or soda nearby, that your dog is sleeping soundly at your feet, and that the cat has already been brought inside, because we will take no commercial breaks. It's just going to be me, you, and my guest for the next hour. Welcome, everyone. Welcome, and thank you so very much for tuning in to my little video here. We are a show that loves to act all innocent, but we understand all the dirty jokes. Tonight's sponsor is Clear Choice Restoration, your helping hand when it comes to hail, wind, and storm damage. Most people don't even know that they may indeed have damage to their roof, gutters, and siding. And with all the storms that's hit Indiana the past couple of weeks, Clear Choice is your people. You will need to call to get the damage fixed. Call Clear Choice Restoration for a free roof inspection and tell them that Al sent you. In Indiana, call 317-358-8630. That's 317-358-8630. Call and schedule for your free inspection today. Well, my special co-host tonight is Sierra Tregaskis. So I guess first off, I need to ask her if I pronounced her name right.
Yes, you did.
Is it Tregaskis?
Yes, Tregaskis. Oh,
that is probably something that I should have asked you while we were hanging out 15 minutes before the show started. I didn't even think about it till just now. Sierra is the founder of Luminosity Paranormal Researchers out of Reno, Nevada. She's got many years' experience investigating the paranormal, and she's going to be with us all night tonight, listening in, asking questions, and making everything better. So welcome, Sierra, and thanks for being on the show tonight. How are you doing?
I am good. I'm doing well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Last week, I thought I was having a heart attack before the show, but all is well. This week, everything is fine. No heart attack. So I think that's good.
Jesus.
I love helping to promote my mighty friends, and everything's better when two people are on it, right? Are you nervous tonight?
I'm a little nervous. I'm not going to lie, but I'm excited, more excited than anything.
Well, I understand you had some fun experiences at your old homestead today. What's been going on over there?
Oh, my goodness. A lot. There's been some interesting things happening lately. Actually, last night is really when it started. We heard some shuffling on our kitchen floor, and we weren't sure what it was, as there was nothing there. So we left a recorder going last night, and we left one going today when we left the house, and we caught several different EVPs and very interesting sounds. There's like a weird shuffling noise that constantly happened through the entire hour recording. And just very interesting voices that we've caught.
Well,
so,
it sounds like
yeah.
you've got an active house. And do I hear that your parents aren't all that excited about having unknown ghost guests at the house?
Oh, no. Nope. They're not happy about it. In fact, my dad has had his own experiences here, and he every time he does have one, he says, "I think you brought a friend home." So he's not very thrilled about it. So.
Well, is he learning about it for the first time right now that you've got some EVPs at the house today?
Yes. Yes, he is. Dad, if you're listening, I apologize. Brought another buddy home.
Yeah. Before we get to my mighty guest tonight, I just want to talk real quickly about my one weird thing. I did not know this. I had no idea until just recently that Indianapolis, Indiana has its own set of catacombs. Who would have thought Indianapolis has catacombs? I had no idea, but it's right. Under the city market in downtown Indy lay a vast brick catacombs with uneven floors, unfinished floors. That's, I guess that's all that remains of what used to be the Tomlinson Hall. And my understanding is that the Tomlinson Hall, it was built back in 1886 and was Indy's premier exposition hall until it was completely burned down in 1958. The catacombs beneath the hall are all that remain, and they served as a nightly homeless shelter in Indianapolis until the early 1900s. And during this time, it got its unwelcome tag as being haunted. And I guess if you're brave enough and if you're not afraid of being touched by spirits of confused homeless people, and if you want to shell out a few bucks, you can schedule a tour through the Indiana landmarks. It'll be worth your while. And that's this week's One Weird Thing. So tonight, our special guest is John Witt. John earned his first paycheck as an actor at the ripe old age of 10. He was had 40 years of experience as a reporter and editor on radio and in TV and newspapers and the wire service. He was a wire service journalism. He was editor of the Sunday Richmond Times-Dispatch in Virginia and retired as an editor of the TimesDispatch.com. And as an actor, he's worked in films including Lincoln, Ithaca, Coming Through the Rye, and Shooting the Prodigal, and has appeared on TV series including Turn, my favorite, Mercy Street, and Legends and Lies, American Genius, A Haunting, and was also on the PBS documentary The First Official Thanksgiving. I've loved watching John on PBS's Mercy Street and feel that his role in the episode of TLC's A Haunting that depicted my house and my experiences at a haunted house for 7 years, struggling, living through that house, that he was exceptionally terrifying. So I'm very excited to talk with you, John. Welcome to Off the Air.
Well, thanks, Al. It's a pleasure to be here, and I hope I can live up to that glowing introduction.
Well, you and I have this connection through my episode of A Haunting, Fear Feeders. As people are listening to the radio show tonight, you can go to YouTube, pull it up, or go to Netflix or wherever A Haunting's being shown, and you can put that on pause and wait to watch it after the radio show's over here. You portrayed what the show called the old man ghost or the angry old man ghost. Tell me what it's like to get into character for something like that. What kind of things take place before you start to shoot or prepare for character or role?
Well, I really didn't know too much. Obviously, I didn't know you. I hadn't read the book. I didn't even know there was a book. They only told me that this was a new type of spirit for the show, that it was a theater ghost that drew its strength from the negative emotions of its victims, fear and anger. And so that helped a little. The script really didn't give me much to go on. There were no lines, and the stage directions were, you know, the ghost floats across the room, Al is startled. So I really didn't, I knew it would all be visual. And of course the makeup helped a lot. I would spend 2 hours every day in the makeup chair, translucent gray skin, blue veins popping out underneath, black eyes and mouth. They even painted the inside of my nostrils black But the worst thing was the white contacts. They were a real pain to put in, but they made me look pretty creepy. So I was trying to think, you know, Boris Karloff did Frankenstein with all of that heavy makeup, and he still managed to get a wide range of emotions across. The only emotions I knew that this character would have were like hate and hunger. And so I invented a couple of things that I hope would get that across. I turned my hands into claws and would clutch and unclutch as if I was getting ready to attack some prey. And I kept my face moving, the forehead and the lips and the eyes. The idea was that I thought that there would be a veil between the dead and the living, and it would be like looking through antique press glass, where when something moves, it kind of, it's not clearly seen. It flickers. And so that was my goal in doing that, and I think it helped a little.
Yeah, you did really good. It was terrifying, even for me to watch it. You may not know this, but that the ghost that you portrayed, I saw that ghost, the old man ghost, but it was a ghost that I actually only saw for like maybe 5 seconds total. But the producers of A Haunting used that ghost like throughout the entire episode, you know, to depict what they were calling, you know, a feeder. And that was kind of a term that was coined by one of the paranormal investigators at my house. They started calling them feeders. And how often does that sort of thing happen in the making of like a real life drama TV show? How often do producers take like those huge liberties like they did? You know, 5 second experience I had ended up being a 45 minute show.
Well, I'm glad that they gave me more than 5 seconds of airtime.
Right,
that's for sure.
Right.
You know, anytime you tell a story, whether it's historic or real life, it's shades of gray. It's very complicated, and it's hard to tell a story with all those nuances in 45 minutes, which is all you have between commercials on a one-hour show. So they have to oversimplify and they have to make priorities. And I think what they did was they made this character represent all the evil that was aimed at you. And as you know, there were a total of 3 feeder ghosts and one great scene where we all loomed over your bed, scared you half to death, and then I choked you within an inch of your wife, which was a tricky scene to film because we actually had to have a safety signal in case I got too carried away and he started to pass out.
Poor Calvin Brown, right? You're going to choke Calvin Brown
out
on my bed.
Well, and Calvin was a real trooper. I mean, he looked like he was terrified and drawing his last breath, even though I was doing my best to fake the clutch around his throat and not actually strangle him.
Mm-hmm. Hey, how many days or was it a week or how long did it take to film the whole thing?
This particular show does one episode in a week. And while it's only an hour, well, 45 minutes of airtime, it takes, you know, for every 30 seconds on the screen, it may take an hour or two to set up and break down and rehearse it and do take after take after take until they get everything just the way they want it to be. So I think I was actually on set for 4 very long days that ranged anywhere from 10 to 12 hours. And, of course, you know, makeup and then just sitting around waiting for my turn to be on set. But, yeah, it takes a lot of time to put together a show like that.
I had to sign a waiver with them when I was being taped for the show that stated simply that I was, you know, everything I was saying was truthful and that the producers were not going to make anything up, meaning that if I didn't say that there was a big gorilla in the closet, they weren't going to put a big gorilla in the closet, you know. So anything that I said had to be truthful, but then on their side, they wouldn't take too many liberties and lie about things that didn't happen. You know, in order to make the show compelling and interesting, they had to, you know, like you said, make the old man ghost kind of the representative of all the feeders that were going on in the house. What kind of secret agreements does an actor have to, you know, an actor portraying a character in a show like you did that you have to sign? You know, what's the fine print that we don't know about?
Well, it's different because we are pretending. but that what we have to sign is an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. And with us, they're more worried about plot twists and spoilers getting out. So we can't do any interviews that they don't authorize before the show airs. We can't post on social media anything about the show or the plot or the script or our characters. We can't take photos on the set. It's basically a pledge of secrecy so that we won't spoil the show for the people who are seeing it for the first time.
How many episodes of A Haunting have you been on? And obviously my episode, Fear Feeders, was your favorite, I'm sure, right?
That's absolutely true. I've done three of these, and Fear Feeders was the first, and I'm not just saying it because I'm on the air with you, but that one was a real challenge. Doing all that, the only sound I was able to make was one maniacal laugh, and they exaggerated that with sound effects. So it did sound really scary. But it was a real challenge to do. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was a great cast and a great show, and, you know, it was a lot of fun to do. The other two, there was one, and that episode was called Demon's Lair, and I had a very short scene in that as an exorcist. And the cool thing about it was they tried to emulate the famous poster from the movie where the exorcist is standing silhouetted by the streetlight and looking up at the house where
they're by
the
stairs. Sure,
and this was a truly haunted house. It was a very scary place. It needed a good exorcist. Of course, my character wasn't very good at it. The exorcism didn't take, and they had to solve the problem another way. But that was fun to do. And again, that one was all with facial expressions and eyes as I stood there and, you know, gauged how difficult a job this was going to be, and I knew I was up against something truly evil. But the last one was called Ghostly Voices, and that one just aired fairly recently. And in that one, I played a priest who directs a lost soul into the light to help him escape. And that one was great because it was a solid supporting role with a lot of dialogue and a lot of interaction with the other characters on the show. And it was a completely different, you know, Fear Feeders, I was the ultimate bad guy. In Ghostly Voices, I was the ultimate good guy. And the nice thing about that is the real-life priest that I was playing actually sent me a very lovely thank you note at the end saying that I had captured the essence of his experience. And that's not something that we hear very often. You know, most of the people that I play have been dead for 150 years. So it was nice to hear from a living soul who thought I'd done a good job.
Right.
So, John, have you personally had any paranormal experiences in your life, like ghosts, aliens, Bigfoot, or even a large pterodactyl? I understand your mom also is a sensitive.
That's true. I haven't seen any pterodactyl. But, and I'm not sensitive myself, although I've had experiences in my life that lead me to believe that what we can take in through our five senses is not all that exists in the universe. There's a great quote from Shakespeare, "There's more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in your philosophy." And I think that that's very true. I think that, there's so much we don't know that it's sort of arrogant of us to put limits on what is reality and what's not. But as far as my mom, she called herself a simple country girl, but there was nothing simple about her. For one thing, she was the ultimate lie detector. I mean, you could not put one over on mom. And I'm a pretty good actor, but I could never make her believe anything that wasn't so. But the other thing about her was, even after, you know, they moved 600 miles away, she would still call me at the darndest times. If I had a wreck, if I had got a promotion, somehow the phone would ring a few minutes later, and if it was something bad, she would say, "Are you all right?" And if it was something good, she would say, "What's new with you?" And, you know, she had this way of just honing in on the precise moment when something was happening. She didn't always know the details, but she was connected enough that she knew when good things or bad things were happening to the kids. And she told me a ghost story that I still, it still kind of boggles my mind. My grandfather had emphysema, and when it got really difficult for him to breathe, they took him into the hospital, and she and my mother and grandmother just basically camped out in his room for several days. And finally, the doctor came in and said, "Look, you two are exhausted. He's stable. Go home, get some rest. We'll call you if anything happens." So they got in the car, and Mom drove out to my grandmother's house in the country. They were both exhausted. They went to separate bedrooms and fell fast asleep. And she said she went from being just in a coma, totally unconscious, to wide awake in the blink of an eye. And she didn't know why. There was no noise. She hadn't woken from a dream. And she looked at the clock, and it was about 2:30 in the morning, and there was a glow in the corner of the room. And she said, you know, there's no light source in the room. The curtains are drawn. There's nothing coming in from outside. That light shouldn't be there. But it grew in intensity and started to flicker, and she heard her father's voice, not with her ears, but in her head. And he said, "I had to leave. Don't worry about it. I'm at peace. You take care of your mother and know that I love you both." And then the light goes out. Now, obviously, she couldn't go right back to sleep, and she was tossing around trying to decide whether she should go wake her mother and tell her about this. And she finally decided, no, if it's a mistake, if I did dream it, or if I was just so tired that I imagined this, I'm not gonna upset her by telling her. So the next morning, she goes down to breakfast, and my grandmother's made a pot of coffee, and they're just sitting there in silence. And the phone rings, and my mother picks it up, and it's the doctor. And he says, "I regret to inform you, your father passed away last night a little after 2 a.m. You don't need to come to the hospital, but you may want to call a funeral home and start the arrangements." So Mom is trying to keep a straight face. She's trying to keep a poker face so she won't alarm her mother. And she just says, "Thank you," and hangs up. And she looks at my grandmother, and my grandmother says, "You don't have to tell me. I know. He was here last night." And my mom was stunned, but they compared notes, and they both had the identical experience at almost exactly the same time. And what they said was, it wasn't a shock, it wasn't frightening, it was the most comforting thing that could have happened. So they didn't break down until the funeral, when everybody was. But it was, you know, it was an experience she never forgot, and I'll never forget her telling me about it.
That's amazing.
You were telling me this week that you almost drowned in a river, and you ended up saving somebody out of the same river. Tell me about that story.
Well, you know, deja vu and how the past, present, and future are all mixed up. This is something I still can't explain, but I think it's connected. Now, I had an idyllic childhood. My parents rented a rustic cabin on a creek, and it had a rope swing and rapids to go over on an inner tube and one of the best swimming holes you'll ever see. And I was a little tadpole, and my father, who was a great swimmer, taught me when I was about 4.5 or 5, what now the Red Cross and the Navy calls drown proofing, how to, you know, do a dead man's float, how to do a dog paddle, keep your head above water, and how to just relax and not exhaust yourself in the struggle. So I became a good enough dog paddler that I just loved to just go up and down the little beach in the shallow water. But one day I got literally in over my head. And the way the creek is, it tapered off really gradually, but when it hit the middle, all of a sudden it's 8 or 10 feet deep and there's a strong current. So I found myself floating downstream and all by myself, and I panicked and I started fighting. And, you know, when I did that, I started to sink. And, you know, when you're four and a half, you don't have a whole lot of life to flash in front of you, but I really thought this was the end for me. And all of a sudden, everything clarified. Now, I don't know if it was divine intervention. I don't know if it was a guardian angel. I can't explain it. But what came to me was something that I don't think my four-and-a-half-year-old mind could have dreamed up on its own.
Mm-hmm.
I suddenly realized that instead of fighting to go up, I should go down. And so I kind of let myself sink and paddled in the opposite direction to get my feet on the riverbed. And when I did that, I pushed up as hard as I could, and I sailed up, and my head broke the surface. I took a really deep gulp of air and went back down again. And this time when I got at the bottom, I started taking steps along the bottom. It's like a moonwalk, like an astronaut walking on the moon, weightless, you know, where you bounce a few feet. And when I started running out of breath again, I went right back to the surface, got another breath. And pretty soon I was back in shallow water. And when I finally came up, I was gasping a little bit. And my mother was standing on the bank, and she was fussing at me for drifting too far down out of her sight. And she didn't realize what trouble I was in, and I never told, because, you know, when you're 4 and a half, how do you explain that? And you've just been, you know, called out by your mom. So I never really mentioned it and didn't really think about it till years later. Now, if you fast forward 10 years, and now I'm, I don't know, 15, maybe 16, I was a really good swimmer. I used to chase fish in that stream. I used to put a rock on my lap and see how long I could hold my breath, and I got pretty close to 2 minutes.
Wow.
So I was a really good swimmer. And the place where we stayed, there were only about a dozen rustic cabins, and families rented them by the summer. And during the week, there were very few people there. On the weekends, they would just charge people by the carload to park there and have picnics and swim and sunbathe. And one day there was this group of older kids, probably early 20s, and they had smuggled in some beer despite the fact that alcohol was supposedly prohibited there. And they'd gotten loud and raucous, and they were ducking each other and splashing each other and just generally creating a lot of noise and nuisance. And I was out there doing my thing, and I heard somebody say, "Help." And at first I thought it was just, you know, more horseplay. But then I realized that two of them had started to drift into the same area where I'd had my problem. And somebody came from the shore and got one of them with an inner tube, just handed him an inner tube and pulled him back in. But the other one was fading fast. You could see that he was fighting. He was going under. And so it was pure instinct, and I just took off. And, you know, as good a swimmer as I was, he was far enough down that it took me, I don't know, a minute or so to get to him. And when I got there, he'd given up. He was completely underwater. He was vertical in the water with his arms reaching for the surface. His eyes were open. There were bubbles coming out of his mouth and nose, and he was completely still. I mean, that guy was drowning. So I grabbed him by the wrist to try and pull him up, and his reaction was pure panic. He wrapped his arms and legs around me. Now we're both in trouble. We're both sinking. And I guess
was he bigger than you?
Well, yes, he was. Not by a lot, but he just wrapped me up. And so I don't think I consciously thought about what had happened before, but I thought to myself that he wants to go up to the surface, and at any cost, he'll climb over me to do it. So I went down, and when I did that, he let me go. I slipped around behind him, threw an arm across his chest, went to the surface, and managed to side stroke back toward the shore. Well, by this time, my uncles were running down the shore trying to keep up with us as we went down the river. And when I got him to the shore, I was exhausted, and they pulled him up, flipped him over, and started pushing on his rib cage, you know, the old artificial respiration they did before mouth-to-mouth. Nobody's going to do mouth-to-mouth on this guy, because the whole river was coming up along with the beer and his lunch and everything else. And I was just sitting there watching this. And finally he started to cough and draw breath. Took like an hour for the rescue squad to get there because this was so far out in the country. And they took him off, and I never knew who the guy was. I never met him. I know nothing about him. But I often wonder, you know, did I rescue somebody who went on to become a doctor to
save
their lives, or did I rescue somebody who beat his wife and got thrown in prison for shooting somebody in a grocery store? Hold on. But I wonder if those two things were connected, if somehow it was all sketched out in advance and I had to be there to do this, and so I couldn't drown, so he wouldn't drown. I don't have the answer to that.
Yeah, not only that, but it's almost like, you know, what you said 10 years before, it was playing out so that you knew what you had to do under that circumstance. Then 10 years later, you were able to do it and save a guy's life. Wow. Hey, when they brought him to shore, was he not breathing or anything? You said they were giving him the chest compressions.
Like I said, the only sign of life he showed was when he wrapped me up. And once I got him to the surface, he went limp again. And exactly, you know, I'm not a doctor. I have no idea what his state was. I know for sure that he would have drowned if I hadn't gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
And it took him a while to get him to breathe again on his own. They had to do a lot of pumping to get all that liquid out of his lungs before he could draw a breath. So, you know, beyond that, I really have no way to say. If I'd been an investigative reporter then, I would have done a whole lot. I would have found out who that guy was, and I would have interviewed him to find out what he had to say about all that and how he turned out. But
yeah,
I really have nothing
no way
to go on. There's no way to track it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There's probably no way for you to even find out who he is or where he's at now, huh?
Well, rescue squads keep records, but because this wasn't a drowning, and it, you know, I'm sure the guy recovered completely, probably in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. You know, I doubt if there was anything that would have been kept this long.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I know
what am I going to tell them? You know, I don't know the exact date. I only know the county it happened in, and I could probably figure out the year, but there's nothing I could give them to help them find the record if one exists.
I know one thing that I believe strongly is that there are no mistakes in life. I believe that we are here for reasons. I believe there's a purpose for us to be here. I believe that we touch people's lives in ways that we will sometimes never fully understand. And that just seems like one of those situations where you were not only at the right place at the right time, but it was almost like it was destiny. That whole scenario just worked itself out quickly.
I think you're right, and I think the same thing. Now, you were breaking up a little bit. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, my computer. I talk over the computer instead of over my phone, and I get all these messages throughout the entire show. People are sending me messages back and forth, and so every now and then it just breaks up the internet.
You know, I've learned to have a truly open mind, and for a bunch of reasons. And one of them I alluded to earlier, I just think that human beings are very arrogant if they believe that they know what it all means. We all have the same questions.
Yep.
How did I get here? What does this life all mean? Where do we go when we die? And all the major religions have tried to explain it in ways that are similar and slightly different. My personal favorite, I got to meet the Dalai Lama, and it was fascinating to hang with him for a couple of days because he was telling me about life and death from the perspective of somebody who's done it 13 times and is able to retain the memories from each of those lives. And it was fascinating to hear him talk about it. And, you know, his explanation of it was very succinct. He said, if you've ever seen those Buddhist paintings where the Buddha is sitting in the center and around him like the rings of a rainbow are all of these levels of characters that are, some are demigods, some are demons, male, female, animal, all kinds of things. And what he said is, you know, that everybody thinks that's the artist's imagination, but that's the reality that I live in. I am aware of all these spiritual beings around me, some that mean me harm, some that want to do me good, and that as we live our lives, if we, you know, follow the path that's set for us and do the right thing as often as we can, then none of that is ever going to bother us. But we get help and hindrance from you know, spirits that we never know are there. I mean, I'd love to hear more about your experience, because I think that that's some of what happened to you.
Yeah, you know, I did an interview a couple of, I don't know, may have been a couple of months now, and I posed the question to the person, because I like to tell people whenever I do book signings or whatever for my books, I like to tell them that I've got a million stories, but I don't have any answers. And she kind of questioned me on that, and she said, I don't know. I think maybe you do have answers. You're just not ready to kind of admit it yet. And she's like, don't you believe that God puts you in certain situations? And I'm like, well, sure. And she's like, don't you believe that God wants the best for you? And I'm like, absolutely, I believe that. And she goes, well, then I've got to believe that you lived 7 years in a haunted house for a reason. Now you tell me what's different now in your life that was not the same prior. And honestly, there's a tremendous amount different in my life now. And it's almost as if that situation caused me to drop some baggage that I carried around in my life, and the beliefs that I thought were important that really aren't important in life. So my faith or my belief in God and my relationship with God is a lot different now. It's really a lot stronger because I've eliminated some things that used to be too much baggage from religion, and I've gone from religious to relational. So yeah, I think there are things that happen in your life for a reason, and that's, you know, that's kind of where I'm at too.
I truly believe that, and I think that you are more self-sufficient and more confident as a result, because you know you can overcome anything that comes your way. And that, you know, that's what happened to me is I, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I think that that's absolutely true, that the experiences we have are train us to go through life on a more even keel and have some hope at the end of it.
Absolutely true. Hey, so John, I hear that you were a boxing referee at one time. So can you give me all the details on that? Tell me how fun it must have been.
You know, it really was. And how I got into it, I was a wrestler in high school, and I was pretty good at it, but there was always somebody better. I wrestled second string under four state champions. And the coach wanted us to have an off-season sport, something to keep us in shape. And I used to go down to the old police athletic league gym and spar with the juvenile delinquents. And I couldn't beat all of them either. But, you know, it's like there was a great poem about my arms are too short to box with God. Well, that was me. I could handle myself, but there were always guys with more experience who could just whip me up. So I got my nose a little crooked and one ear a little lumpy, and I sort of gave it up. But years later, I always retained this respect for the guys who make it look easy, because I know how much work it takes to appear natural doing something like that. So years later, I'm working at a radio station as the news director, and the local boxing coach comes around, and he's looking for promo time for some bouts that are coming up. And we got to talking, and he realized I was a fan, and he asked me if I wanted to be the announcer. And so, you know, I did that a few times, you know, ladies and gentlemen in this corner. And so one night the referee didn't show up, and the coach said, well, I can't work in the corners and in the ring both. Would you do it? And I said, well, you know, I don't know the rules. I mean, I don't have an idea. He said, just do it, and I'll coach you a little from the side. So I did, and I made a fool of myself, but I had a great time doing it. It was the best seat in the house. It was a chance to actually, you know, help the safety of these kids who are competing. And so I stuck with it, and the next thing I know, I mean, I'm refereeing everywhere. I used to go to I went to every prison in the state of Virginia, including the maximum security places, and they would bus in the meanest inmates from the other places, and they would have these grudge matches. And those things, the rules went out the window, and I'd have to put my foot on one and my arm around the throat of the other and try and pry them apart without getting myself hit. But I got enough experience that, you know, I started to move up, and I was on the amateur side. I refereed the PAL Nationals. That was in Indianapolis. And I did up to the semifinals of the AAU Nationals. And then I started working with pros, and I wound up judge and referee working 9 title fights for the IBF. And they would send me on these wonderful trips. I went to not only, you know, Atlantic City and Las Vegas, but I refereed on the deck of a aircraft carrier. I worked in France and Spain and Italy and South Africa and, you know, in every situation you could imagine. And it was just a great experience. I mean, if you haven't figured it out by now, I'm something of a risk taker. You know, riding a motorcycle at 100 miles an hour on a twisty road, doing the kind of things that you've heard me talk about. It's a way for me to get in that zone where it's quiet time. I don't know how to explain it except, you know, if you've ever been in a car wreck, the last 2 seconds before you hit something, time stands still. You don't hear anything. You don't see anything. You're so focused, but everything in you is alive. And you know, I think Charlie Manson was the one who said, you're never more alive than at the moment you think you're going to die. And I think that there's some of that here. I became an adrenaline junkie, and this was the way to get it. And the odd thing was, my real job as a journalist was incredibly stressful. You know, long hours and crazy deadlines and competition, and, you know, and nobody seemed to like what I wrote about them. And to relax, I got in the ring with 2 guys who were trying to take each other's heads off. I can't explain it, but it helped, and it was a lot of fun, and I wouldn't trade those experiences for anything.
Who were some of the main names of the boxers? Is anybody that we would know?
Well, you know, it depends on how big a fan you are. There was a guy named Pernell Sweet Pea Whitaker, and he was an Olympic gold medalist. He grew up in Norfolk in the projects, got married in the boxing ring, wound up giving his mother a house with his proceeds. And I kind of came up at the same time he did because I was in Virginia too. And I refereed his first fight as an amateur. When he won his first championship, I didn't go to the Olympics, but I saw him at the Olympics. Then I got to referee him after he and that there was a whole crowd of them. Now, I can't tell you which year it was, but the U.S. won like half a dozen of the 12 weight classes in the Olympics. Mm-hmm. They came back as a group, and they were traveling around the country boxing as a group, and I got to referee a couple of those guys. But most of what I did was it's very political. And, of course, in Atlantic City or Las Vegas, where the high rollers go and the big fights go, they have their own staff, and you're not going to break that lineup very often. Most of what I did is in the European championships, they always wanted neutral officials. So they would bring in a lot of American referees and judges who didn't have, you know, I remember one I did, it was an amazing story, but we probably don't have time to hear it all, but it was an Italian champion and a French challenger, and they'd fought twice before to contested split decisions. And one of the judges was Italian, one of the judges was French, and I was the neutral judge. And the place was divided between French gangsters and Italian mobsters, and I knew the roof was going to come off the place when it was over. But they got us out of there safely, and that's another story for another day. But it was just – it was a series of adventures. And it was like, you know, I truly count myself as lucky because I've had all of these different careers. And as a journalist, you know, I sailed with Jacques Cousteau and flew with the Blue Angels and watched Muhammad Ali's fights from ringside and, you know, interviewed presidents and queens and murderers in their jail cells. Mm-hmm. And they're just, it's impossible to put a value on those life experiences. And the fact that I'm still having a whole lot of fun in retirement doing the acting thing is, it's just gravy. I don't know what I did to deserve this, but I'm going to enjoy it as long as the ride lasts.
Hey, we've got a couple
questions.
Adventures. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Ask your question.
Oh, I was just saying, so many adventures. It sounds incredible.
Yeah, we've got a couple of questions in the chat room I wanted to get to real quick. Anissa Gooding asks, what role has John played that he feels he relates or related to the most? And what was the hardest role that you had to play or prepare for?
Well, you know, it's funny that the first role I ever had, the first screen acting job I ever had, was working for Steven Spielberg in a scene with Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Field in Lincoln. And mm-hmm. I was so completely over my head. I didn't have any lines, but it was a climactic death scene. And I was playing the pastor, the president's pastor, holding a Bible and praying over Lincoln as he died. And I just remember I was about to faint in that room. And so the pain on my face did look real. And I've been, you know, ever since working for Spielberg, I've been working my way downhill. But I've had a ball doing everything. They're all different. I got to play another ghost fairly recently in a short film, and it started out as one of the it's a tragic comedy, where this girl is very distraught. She goes to a grave in the cemetery and says, "Oh, Dad, I miss you so much. I need your help. I need your advice." And I show up and I say, you know, "Oh, my child, I feel for you, but there's nothing I can do." And she keeps on saying that she needs my help. And finally, I lose my temper and say, "I told you there's nothing I can do. I'm not your father. You're at the wrong grave." And it was a challenge to do that one, because in the space of just a couple of minutes, I had to go from, you know, Mr. Caring to, you know, get off my plot. And my son watched it, and he said when he first started seeing it, he's thinking about the fact that someday he's going to lose his father. And he's sitting there, and he's in a group of people, and he's got tears in his eyes. And then a couple of minutes later, he's laughing his head off. And so, you know, for me, that was success, because if I could influence his emotions, I knew that it was probably working the same way, although not as intensely, for the audience that would later see this thing. But, you know, every one of them is different. They're all a challenge. That's the fun of it, is you become somebody completely different and try and make their feelings and personality just as realistic as you possibly can.
Yeah, I hear a lot about, like, you know, the big Hollywood actors that are making all the millions of dollars, how they really get into the role and then they transform themselves, and for the next 4 hours they're no longer that person, you know, they're the character that they're playing. Do you find yourself doing that sometimes, where you're just so entranced in your role that it kind of becomes you?
I wouldn't say that, you know, because I don't feel that way. If I did, I would never have been able to play this fear feeder character, because that would have dogged me if I'd carried that much that much malevolence around with me. For me, it's temporary, and I'm trying to feel it while I'm doing it, and I can leave it alone as soon as I finish. And there are others, and I've seen some of them work. I'll go back to Daniel Day-Lewis. He was such a method actor that when he came to Richmond to play Lincoln, he rented a house that was that dated back to the Civil War. He turned off all the electricity in the place and lived this primitive life for the whole shooting of, I think it was about 4 months. And when he was on the set, even Spielberg couldn't call him by anything but Mr. Lincoln or Mr. President. And,
wow.
You know, he was in character from the time he walked on till the time he left. And the day we did that death scene, he walked in looking a little pale in his nightshirt spattered with blood. And Spielberg whispered in his ear, he lied and lay down on the bed and he died. for about, we spent all day shooting that scene, and his chest never moved, his eyes never blinked, he never moved a muscle the whole time, even when they were between takes, he just didn't move. And Sally Field, we heard her crying before she ever got to the set.
Really?
And she never stopped. They would come up to adjust her makeup. They would move the mic around. They would do all the stuff touching her and making suggestions to her. She never stopped crying for the whole day. So I give them all the credit in the world. I'll never be that good. But I really, it's like the boxing thing. I wasn't that good at it, but I admire the people who make it look real and make it look simple.
Yeah. We're probably going to go over time. As long as you both can stay on for a few more minutes. I hope you can, right?
Broke up a little bit, but yes.
Okay. Well, we've got a couple of callers. I want to get to the callers. So I'm going to pull one of these callers up. Here's the fun thing about callers. I don't know who they are. I don't know what they got to say. So this is just going to be fun. We're just going to pull somebody up and say, find out what's going on. Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Here's the fun thing about.
Hi.
I don't know who they are. I don't know.
I can hear myself in the background. What's your question? Well, see, that's what makes it so much fun, is you have no idea what they're going to ask, or if they're going to ask anything at all.
Well, you knew it was somebody who was listening because we could hear.
Yeah.
Right. Here's one more caller. I think I have an idea who this caller is. Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, what's up, Aldo?
Rebecca, how are you, girl?
Hello. I'm awesome, Sierra. Love you guys.
Hi, Rebecca. We love you,
what's
too.
What's up? So, hey, John.
Hey, Rebecca.
Hey, I just wanted to say, you know, I've really enjoyed listening in. I love your storytelling, and you had an awesome, nice, soft Southern drawl like my dad. It's really been a pleasure listening to you and your stories. But, you know, it's funny. It's like every time I listen to Aldo's show, there's always a synchronistic moment for me. So I had one with you, and you were talking about your near drowning. I've actually experienced the same. So, and actually my uncle was the one who pulled me out. So I thought that was weird when you said your uncles were running down trying to rescue you and whatnot. But yeah, like that was really cool story. But I wanted to ask a question. Okay, so knowing what you know about Aldo's haunted house, would you have been able to live there for 7 years?
Wow. I think I would have bailed long before he did.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, maybe they would have followed me, maybe they wouldn't, but I would not have been as stubborn or as brave as he was to stick it out. You know, life's too short to suffer like that. And I don't know what made him do it. In fact, we should ask him that question. Why did you stay through all of that
misery?
Why
did you stay?
Oh, Lord Almighty. Well, it's a simple answer. It's all about money. When you invest so much money into a place, you know, my father, you know, came through right there at the end and really, you know, I borrowed a ton of money from him in order to get into the house, and everything I had was invested into the house, right? So
it all
was
boils
hard
down
to
economics.
Yeah, it was really hard to walk away because I just didn't have anything. You know, I couldn't just pack up and go. Everything I had was in the house. And so I was a little stubborn because early on I really didn't believe that it was real, kind of, even though it was happening to me. So I kind of thought that there, you know, it was in my mind. I had been going through that terrible divorce and just all kinds of things were going on in my life. I had lost a job while I was there early on. And so it was just a struggle.
Perfect feeding grounds.
That's right.
You know, you should have known that, like, the third time the garage door opened, every time you would approach that, I'm ready to feed on you. It's just crazy.
You know what,
and the story has such crazy energy that it makes the reader experience things as they're reading it. So that's what's, I've never gone through that before. Like I've said before, your book was the craziest, scariest, creepiest story I've ever read, knowing it was real, too, so.
Yeah.
Kudos to you for enduring and being able to share that.
Yeah. Well, I think that the haunting episode could have been far better if they used different scenarios that had happened at the house. But they wanted to depict feeders, and so that's mm-hmm. the direction they wanted to go. But I think the scariest thing that happened at the house really was seeing the little girl. I had seen her a couple of times. She appeared to me. She had appeared to a number of other people who had gone there too. And she would whisper in my ear at night, and she would grab my hand when I walked down the hallway or into the kitchen. And she would get mad when I'd pull my hand away and tell her not right now type of stuff. And she'd throw shit all over the house.
The classic demon disguise, the little girl.
Yeah, right. So I think there were a lot more scary things that happened, but you know.
On so many levels, so many different bizarre things. It's almost like that area is like in like some kind of weird, where it's like interdimensional, or there's some weird portal, or like there's something going on. There's something. I think it's multi-layered, though. Very creepy. I feel bad for people that are there now.
Right. Yeah. There were a lot of things that happened prior to me moving in. There was a lot of deaths on the property. I did a lot of research when I've been working on my new book, Awaken the Feeders, and did hundreds of hours of research into the property and everything. So there's a lot going on there. There was Indians, there were deaths, there were suicide, there was all kinds of crazy things there. So it was just a strange plot of land. And, yeah. So, John,
happened to get to enjoy it for 7 years.
Right.
The
ancients
had this theory about, I'm sorry, but what you said made me think that the ancients had this theory about the genus loci, the spirit of the place, that certain places around the globe are, you know, they're homes to spirits that are either benevolent or malevolent. And depending on where you happen to land and how sensitive you are, these things happen over and over at the same places to generation after generation of people. And it's all because the place, for some reason, attracts either good or evil. What that all means or how it happens, I don't know. But almost every ancient civilization has a theory like that.
Very reminiscent of Stephen King's Pet Sematary.
Yep.
Yeah, I can completely believe in that. Absolutely.
Yep.
So, John, thanks for calling, Rebecca. You want to hang on for a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm here.
John, I like to talk with my guests about, you know, I believe that everybody has something that they just know to be true. There's an important lesson or a fact about their life that they've come to discover, or something, some valuable sort of information that we who've not walked in your shoes, we may not fully understand, but you understand. So I love asking people the question, what's the most important thing that you can share with us tonight?
I think you just about hit it on the head when you talked about we all have a different path. And I think that it behooves us not to ever judge anyone else. You know, one of the big problems in the world today is this clash between nations and cultures and religions. And the fact is, we're all human, and none of us knows, you know, anybody who says, I know the truth, and anybody who doesn't believe what I believe or live where I live, you know, doesn't get it, deserves to burn in hell, deserves to be murdered in their sleep. You know, that's to me, it just doesn't make any sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that there are so many different ways to reach the ultimate truth, that anybody who's trying deserves our respect. And that's all I got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's almost
like
going to take something like an alien invasion to convince, you know, people otherwise that we're all the same. We're all one.
Yeah. I like to tell people that it doesn't matter what you believe. And I, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it would have been very hard for me to make that statement. But I really believe it now, that it doesn't matter what you believe. You just have to believe. Believe in something. Believe in that there's something bigger than you. Believe that there's something more important than you. Believe that you have a part of a life that's beyond your life too. Your life emanates into the lives of your family, into the lives of your friends, into the person who's walking down the sidewalk, and you bump shoulders into them. I mean, it's just important that you believe that you have a purpose, that there's a reason that you can make a difference. And you never know what's going on behind the eyes of other people. And it's important that you treat people with respect. And no matter what, if you want to believe in Buddha, if you want to believe in Jesus, if you want to believe in whoever else is out there, the Hare Krishnas, it don't matter. Just believe in something.
Yeah. Something more, you know, that's why I'm so grateful for even the most negative paranormal experiences that I've ever had, because it really shows me that there's something way more than what you see every day when you wake up, something way deeper.
Absolutely.
And it's so strange that you can't even wrap your mind around it at this point. Like, if we knew the ultimate truth, it would like blow our minds.
Mm-hmm. Hey, John, we've got some final questions for you, and Sierra and I are going to ask you these questions. Sierra, you got your questions in front of you, number 11 there, that you can help me ask?
Oh, yes. Let's see.
Okay. You go ahead and I'll start here. John, I ask these questions to all my guests, and I just want to know. I'm going to start with the first one, and then Sierra will come in after me. But I want to know, do you believe that aliens are visiting our planet?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, Carl Sagan put the numbers out there. You know, if you believe that in all the billions and billions of stars and galaxies and planets, and now we've even found some in the Goldilocks zone where they're not too hot and not too cold and where they've got water and could sustain life even as we know it, much less than many other kinds, and how hard life works to survive on this planet, and, you know, where volcanoes are erupting or where it's under the ice, frozen for years and years and years. You know, life wants to exist and continue, and it, you know, there's no reason for us to believe that we are all there is, and this is the only place where life exists. And they're going to visit us because we're just the best show in town.
I mean, I know
the
it, right.
Things that we do. what entertainment? This is like the Earth sitcom. You know, it's going to be,
right.
If I were an alien, I would pull up a chair and watch this because
just
it's hilarious,
Truman Show.
The silly things we do. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that answer. That's awesome. I want to ask Sierra that question, though. Like, do you feel the same way? Or
I do. I do believe that aliens do visit our planet. I do believe that there is more than just us. I don't know how much more I believe, you know, like the expansion of that is just, I do feel that there's more to the world and the universe than just us. There has to be. I mean, so much space.
And
you know,
I've seen
there
it.
That's
yeah.
true. That's
I can
right.
vouch for them. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah,
we had
to
experience.
Without
so,
a doubt.
John.
Yes. So, John, do you think Bigfoot lives in Indiana?
Yes, but I'm not allowed to reveal his whereabouts. I mean, it's
right.
a privacy thing. He's, you know, very private and doesn't want me to tell where you can find him.
Well,
oh,
I have my cousin runs the Indiana chapter of the Bigfoot, Finding Bigfoot. I don't know, I forget what he calls it, Indiana Bigfoot Research Organization or something like that. He runs it. My cousin runs it. So he absolutely believes
wow.
that there's Bigfoots in southern Indiana. And, you know, there could be, I guess, in southern Indiana. There's a lot of woods, a lot of wilderness. But honestly, it's one of those things. I believe in Bigfoot, but I just think he's probably way up in Canada somewhere where no human
has
ever stepped
foot. It's one of those unanswerable questions, but we do know that they're constantly finding life forms on this planet they didn't know exist,
mm-hmm.
especially under the sea. It happens all the time.
Yep.
And they'll find
yep.
some new butterfly they never knew existed or something they thought was extinct thousands of years ago. So,
absolutely.
You know, we're going to keep making discoveries like this, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if there wasn't some missing link ape-human bear hybrid out there that –
is hairy and smells bad. I meet people like that on the street every day.
Asking for
John. John, who killed JFK?
I don't know, but there are certainly a lot of conspiracy theories, and there were certainly a lot of people that weren't unhappy to see him go. You had the Cubans, you had the Russians, you had the mob, and you had the people in the CIA and in the government itself who thought that he was doing too much too soon and in the wrong direction. So, you know, while today we celebrate him as, you know, a great loss and one of the best presidents we ever had, at the time he was a very controversial figure. And, you know, who's to say? I don't believe that the Warren Commission had all the facts, and I'm not sure that we have them all today or ever will. It's going to go down as one of those things people are going to continue to talk about because it's a mystery. And I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, I still hold firm that I believe we killed him. The CIA or some government official somewhere killed him. That's what I believe.
Well, not
or at
we,
least
they
knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
So did we actually land men on the moon? What's your thought?
Oh, of course. Of course. I talked to a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
And many years later, I did interview a couple of those astronauts, and they are just those guys wouldn't know how to lie if they tried. They are scientists and just some of the smartest people ever, and absolutely
right.
Yes. And it's, you know, it's there are lots of conspiracy theories, and some of them you want to believe and some of them you don't. This one I just refuse to believe. It's one of those things where it'd been too hard to keep a secret that big that involved so many people telling us lies. So, you know, they're still today finding anomalies and videos and photographs from the satellites and the moon and all that stuff. So to pick apart what evidence we have of that is kind of silly. But, yes, we absolutely did. It was a great achievement, and we should be proud of it and stop second-guessing it.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Right on.
John, when you pass away, do you have like a list of people that you're going to haunt?
Nope. I am.
No, you're not going
to
haunt anybody.
What comes next. Absolutely. You have nothing to worry about. I will not come back and pester you. But, you know, for me, I so badly want to find out what's coming next. And I think, and if it's only a good rest, I'll need it by then. The last thing I want to do is wander around the same old halls day after day, repeating the same old actions in the same old way and looking at the same old people. It's just, it's not me.
Okay.
That would be, for me, that would be hell. And so
yeah.
When I'm gone, I'm gone. I'm on to the next adventure, and I can't wait to get there.
That is, well, that's a really good answer. I like that. Thank you.
Yes.
Well, we've kind of run out of time here, and I want to thank Sierra for coming on and being my special co-host. Yeah, she's going to do that a couple more times for me in the months ahead. And Rebecca, thanks again for coming on and adding some color to my
thanks
show.
Thanks for having me.
Looks
definitely.
Like this is probably going to become like your what do you call it? Like your special spot.
I'm
is the Rebecca
every
time.
Show of yours, basically.
Right. Right.
I'm gonna leave my mark.
Right. So John, it's been so good to talk to you and to get to know you through the interview and talking with you over the internet. And I promise I'll get a book out to you. I know I made that promise to you. I haven't fulfilled it yet, but it seems like every time
I bring it up, I was gonna let you off the hook. But
well, it seems like every time I get books in, I gotta send them right back out, and it's hard to keep any for free, you know, that I can pass out.
I know that. That's true.
Yeah.
Well,
it's
I've
been
got
great.
Family in Indiana, and next time I come up there, I'm going to come to your house, knock on your door, and make you give me a book. So
right. Well,
just be warned, it's a haunted book. Public service announcement. Yes, it is. I know firsthand.
Well, I'm hearing the gun room is speaking in Indiana, so you're more than welcome to come by, and I'll give you a book if I got one here. I'll make sure you get one. So thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening tonight, and it's been a lot of fun, and we'll see you next week. Next week, we've got the Paris sisters on, Tina Hicks-Leno and Cheryl Ferguson. They're going to come on. They're going to be talking about my episode of A Haunting and some things that they've got coming up here in the near future, and so that's going to be a fun one, too. I like being able to talk about my haunted house, and the what's great about them is that they had a lot of experiences. They had a lot of verification where I had an experience and then they actually had the same experience at the house plus more. So it's really going to be a really good show for everybody. And so thank you, everybody. And we will see you next week. Off the Air Radio Show is now off the air. Thank you to my guests. Thank you to my sponsors. Thank you to my listeners. And to my two beautiful children, Carter and Reagan, if you're ever lost, I will never stop looking for you.